Hello, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress and a columnist for the American Prospect magazine. With me today is Patrick Christie. He's a senior policy analyst at the Foreign Policy Initiative. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
So I think we discussed a little bit earlier, you did brave the weather to go into the office today. Myself, as viewers can see, I'm safely sheltered in my basement here. Stayed home today because of the snow and also because the kids didn't have school. So managing to get this in while I do other work and manage their snow activities. So what we're going to talk about today is the Iran nuclear agreement. We had an agreement back in November for a joint plan of action creating a six-month interim period wherein the P5 plus one, that's the permanent five members of the UN Security Council plus Germany and Iran, would hopefully negotiate a comprehensive agreement addressing all of the international community's concerns with regard to Iran's nuclear program. That's the goal. That's the theory. After some negotiating since November, there was an agreement on the implementation of that interim agreement, which went into force as of Monday, January 20th. So we are now officially in the six-month period wherein the parties will hopefully negotiate a comprehensive agreement. So, Patrick, Foreign Policy Initiative a few weeks ago released an open letter signed by a number of foreign policy notables calling on Congress to play a role in making sure that the JPA, that's the Joint Plan of Action, the agreement governing the six-month period, was dutifully enforced. Now, I'd like to get into some of the details of that, but if you could first just give me your basic take on the Joint Plan of Action, some of what you see as its strengths and weaknesses, and whether on balance you think this was a good step for the United States.
Well, sure. So, again, thanks for having me. And I braved the weather here, so I'm at the office and had a fun time walking through the snow. But so, as you mentioned, our organization organized and released an open letter the other day. It had, I think, 77 former government officials, foreign policy experts, that urged the Senate and House leadership to kind of move forward and force Iran's full compliance with this joint plan of action and the interim nuclear deal that was signed a few months back in Geneva. And really the purpose of the letter was to say that Congress does have a role to play and has an opportunity to make clear to the regime in Tehran the consequences of violating this agreement. And if they fail to, to follow the text of the agreement, if they fail to conclude an agreement at the end of a one-year period. And so that's kind of the view that I think a number of these experts hold and sign the letter. The interim deal, while there's some positive aspects to it, I think I would say that there's still some flaws, and it's an imperfect agreement. I don't think anyone would expect it to be perfect, but it does prohibit Iran from installing additional centrifuges. That's a positive thing for a 6-month period. At the same time, it prevent Iran from continuing research on advanced centrifuges, which they continue to do, and it doesn't stop the regime from continuing research related to their missile defense program, missile program, ballistic missiles, and nuclear weapons. And that's quite concerning. And I think there's some worries about how Iran can continue to progress down this line.
So looking at the letter, I noticed that it doesn't, I mean, one of the big debates over the past, I guess since, right after the joint plan of action, but even more over the past few weeks, what has been a debate between the White House, the administration, and members of the Senate who, particularly Senator Menendez, Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, and Senator Mark Kirk, a Republican from Illinois, who have offered a new sanctions bill, 1881, I think the Iran nuclear weapons free, the Nuclear Weapons Free Iran Act. I'm not sure if I'm getting that exactly right. But the administration has been really, really you know, coming out strongly against passing this new sanctions bill, even though it does would include a delayed trigger for new sanctions, giving 6 months, giving a delay of 6 months with a possible delay of even more time. But then promising new sanctions after that. You had 10 Democratic heads of Senate committees sending a letter in December, I believe it was, asking Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, not to bring new sanctions up for a vote. So this has been a really, really engaged and fairly aggressive debate on both sides. But I noticed that the FBI letter did not specifically call for the passage of 1881. Could you explain why?
Sure. No, the purpose of the letter was to encourage Congress to play a role. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard to corral opinions in Washington. And so, I mean, there's going to be disagreements on what path Congress should take. So the purpose of the letter was to say that there is a mm-hmm. Congress does have a play to role, and then they should kind of move forward down a certain path. It didn't mm-hmm. specify which path. Now, the legislation that you're talking about is as you mentioned, receiving a lot of attention these days, and the administration has really been pushing back and lobbying members to not go forward. And it sounds like from the latest news, the Senate, I believe, will wait around a couple weeks, maybe a month or so, to see if there's actually some progress in talks and give the administration some room. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you do have, I think you have over 60 senators that have co-sponsored this legislation. And a number of very influential senators. Senator Menendez is, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and is very powerful in terms of these issues. And he calls the issue kind of a diplomatic insurance policy. And reading the text of the language, it says it gives the administration room to negotiate, but also says that if after a full year with flexibility, if Iran doesn't budge, if Iran seems to be cheating or not living up to their obligations, then sanctions will come into force and punish the regime.
So the issue and the administration's response, and in this they are backed up by a new intelligence assessment that says that passing new sanctions, even delayed sanctions, as Menendez-Kirk is, these sanctions would be delayed for the 6 month period, would undermine the chances of the talks succeeding. The Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, told Robin Wright in a Time magazine interview that the passing of new sanctions would just immediately scuttle the talks. Now, granted, he's saying what he has to say for his own political, to deal with his own critics at home. But I think even that is something that we could take a moment to discuss here. I mean, one of the things, a real divide that I see in Washington right now, and I'm interested to hear your perspective on this, is there seems to be a divide when I look at, people who are criticizing and supporting the deal, and even among supporters. But it does basically break down along supporters and detractors of the deal and supporters and detractors of new sanctions. Is the question of how much and to what extent the Iranian system actually has politics, the extent to which Iran is governed by an entirely monolithic system, which is run by the supreme leader and a small circle of advisors and flunkies, or does Iran, is there actual politics that goes on within the system? And that's where I fall down. I recognize Iran is not a democracy as we define it. It is an authoritarian system. The people who can and cannot run are heavily, heavily vetted by an undemocratic committee. But that doesn't mean that politics doesn't exist. That doesn't mean that Rouhani and Zarif, who I would call relative moderates, not moderate in the broader sense, but moderate according to the sort of range of views that's acceptable mm-hmm. inside the Iranian regime as it currently exists. They have their own critics inside the regime. There are much more hawkish elements who believe that there's simply nothing to be gained for Iran in engaging with the West and engaging with the United States in particular. They see all of this as just a trick, a subterfuge to keep Iran Iran under pressure and under isolation, with the ultimate goal in their view being the destruction of the Islamic Republic and regime change in Iran. So my point is, where do you fall on this? I mean, what's your view here? Do you see this all as kind of like a grand plan by the leaders of the Iranian system, by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei? Or do you think that, you know, stuff that the United States does or does not do can actually impact the, you know, the argument and the debate that takes place inside the Iranian regime?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of issues to address, but I think one that comes to mind, the administration has said this for a long time, but the Obama administration has credited tough economic, financial, mm-hmm. international sanctions as, you know, for bringing Iran to the table, the negotiating table. And mm-hmm. it's the first time in a long time that they've had face-to-face discussions. And so I think there is a way to their negotiations have in some way kind of brought them to the table and shaped the dynamics on the ground. Mm-hmm. I mean, economic pressure is clearly impacted the regime and the economy, and, you know, was decreasing in size in 2011 and 2012, and now suddenly, and I think in 2013, and now there's worries that it's starting to grow again. So the economic sanctions did have an impact in terms of bringing them to the negotiating table. In terms of the politics of the, you know, that happened on the ground in Iran, I think that, you know, as you mentioned, there's a spectrum, and that it's very specific spectrum to Iran, and at the end of the day, you know, to run for president in the country, to run for the, you know, the major elections, you have to be approved by the supreme leader, and the supreme leader still holds the final decision-making powers on the nuclear program. And so when we have to kind of take everything with a grain of salt, mm-hmm. because they could pursue this track that maybe they do want to reach a deal, or they could be buying time as they've done in the past, and we've seen this, you know, back in, I think it was 2002, 2003-ish, when the regime did kind of, you know, brag about the fact that they did mislead in the international community. And so that should be a worry, that the regime could be using this to buy more time to continue their research, continue their development of certain programs. And so that should, in the back of our mind, you know, be a present mm-hmm. thought. On the issue of kind of domestically here in the United States, when we look at sanctions and economic pressure, the administration does, you know, as I mentioned, credit sanctions as having a lot to do with kind of where we are right now. It's also worth noting the administration has pushed back against Congress and lawmakers the last couple of years for mm-hmm. further sanctions. Mm-hmm. So the sanctions that they do credit with bringing Iran to the table, they have really opposed. And we look back at in 2011 when it was the Central Bank of Iran, and it was in 2012 the insurance industry, there was a lot of pushback from the administration. Now those two items, which I think were kind of independently attached as amendments to the NDAA, were passed by votes of 100-0, and mm-hmm. I wrote it down, but it, I mean 99-1 maybe. So they do have really broad bipartisan support, and time and time again, seems like the administration has pushed back. Mm-hmm. And I think lawmakers on Capitol Hill have said, like, wait a second, we've been right, you've proven us right on this, and so we continue to believe that this is the right, you know, approach.
Right. No, I think that's a fair point, that the administration has resisted new sanctions. And I'll admit, even myself, I was very, very skeptical, and myself wrote things that were very skeptical, of all these new sanctions that Congress was intent in piling on. And it does seem clear that they have played a role in you know, certainly impacting Iran's economy, and bringing Iran back to the table. I think there's still a question of how big a role. I think the election of Hassan Rouhani and, you know, his new administration and the platform that he ran on is certainly the most important factor here. I think the debate that, you know, that we'll have and we'll probably continue to have is how much of a role the sanctions played in his mm-hmm. victory.
No, that's exactly right. He ran on a platform promising, you know, kind of economic reforms and mm-hmm. economic progress, and that was very important. And, mm-hmm. but it's also at the end of the day that he was, you know, approved by the supreme leader. And so while, you know, his economic reforms were his top priority, the question is, you know, to what extent you know, what else is on the platform? And there, I think we just don't really truly know the answer.
Right. No, and I think it's really important to point out that he was accepted at, among the slate of candidates to run, which of course represented a very small and very right leaning concern, you know, very hawkish leaning pro regime sliver of candidates who applied to run. But I think the fact is it's only, I mean, people tend to bring out the fact that he's a longtime regime stalwart as sort of a criticism. But I think I kind of turn that around and say, well, it's only because his, you know, his revolutionary and pro-regime credentials are so, you know, unquestionable that he has been, you know, permitted and continues to be supported by the Supreme Leader and by some key figures inside the system to explore these negotiations. I'd also note here that he, you know, from what I've read, and I think it seems pretty clear that he was not the Supreme Leader's first choice. But that, you know, judging the Supreme Leader and those around him judged that the damage to the system's legitimacy, such as it is, was from the 2009 elections, which many believe, and I think evidence points to, the fact that it was stolen on behalf of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was the Supreme Leader's preferred candidate at that time. The damage of, you know, to the domestic perception of the regime and its actual legitimacy, it was, you know, the system couldn't sustain that a second time, I think, was the calculation or the perception of the people who were ruling. So they let Rouhani's victory go forward. Now, you know, that's all kind of conjecture based on evidence, but it seems reasonable to me.
But getting that's right. And I would just add on top of what you're saying, I mean, that seems, that's kind of the assessment I think a lot of people will hold. Another assessment, though, is that you know, the economic foundations, and as the economy continues to crumble, or was crumbling, in Iran, it did threaten the kind of foundations of power. And so for the regime to maintain power and kind of retain, you know, their positions of leadership, they were dependent on the Iranian economy to kind of hold them up. And so the further sanctions pressured the Iranian economy, financial sanctions were able to kind of to truly impact the regime, the more of a threat that posed. And so I think another way Rouhani may not have been the top choice, but he was allowed to run. And the fact that he was running on kind of those economic principles was kind of one of the reasons, obviously, that people voted for him, which the regime may not be, you know, too worried about.
Right. But I think, you know, I bring up the fact that he wasn't Khamenei's preferred candidate, just to kind of make the broader point as what I was saying about politics. You know, I think there's a perception among some in Congress that this is all just an entirely, you know, a totalitarian system where, you know, you have this ruler at the top who makes all the decisions, and granted his title is the Supreme Leader, and he is the ultimate decider in the system, but that's not the same as saying that he simply rules everything by fiat and his will is always the law. I mean, he does have to manage, you know, a bureaucracy with competing factions. And right now, the faction that he's supporting is this more, you know, relatively moderate, pragmatic faction. And I think it's right and reasonable to bring up the fact that Rouhani himself talked about, you know, when he was leading the negotiations in the early two, in the 2003, 4, and 5, 6 period, that, you know, he was kind of bragging, you know, well, when I led these negotiations, we were able to keep negotiating while advancing our nuclear program. And I think that's relevant. I also think it is worth, you know, putting that in some context as, you know, an out of power Iranian politician, you know, writing in his memoirs saying, oh, when I, you know, here's this awesome thing I did, which is not unheard of in our system, you know, politicians who leave power writing memoirs and then trying to put stuff that they did when they were in power in the best possible light. But still, it does make the case that we need to have, you know, a very strong system of inspections, that any sanctions relief or any concessions that the U.S. and its partners give to Iran while negotiating or as a package, you know, during negotiations need to be accompanied by very, very stringent verification measures. And I think that's exactly what we've gotten under the JPA, the Joint Plan of Action. I think the inspections that Iran has to submit to have been amplified significantly. You'll have daily versus weekly inspections now at Natanz and Fordo, access to mills and mines that were not occurring before. So it seems to me that question of verification has been addressed to a great extent. Would you agree? Do you take a different view on that?
Well, no, I would just say I think there's still some flaws. It's not perfect. I mean, we mentioned the military dimension, mm-hmm. and so that is still a worry that mm-hmm. there are no inspections of the military facilities, and that's been a worry, I think, from, you know, by the international community for some time. On the same time, I think, you know, the agreement, the interim agreement, does allow some financial some leeway and kind of takes a step back from implementing the full set of sanctions and provides some economic relief, financial relief. Mm-hmm. And there's a worry there. And Senator Menendez and many others have talked about this. You know, sanctions are not a spigot that you can just turn on and off. You know, it has taken a very long time to get where we are in terms of international sanctions. And there's a worry that as we continue to go down this path, it will become more difficult to ramp up those sanctions after we've kind of tamped them down. And we're seeing, you know, we've seen Iran's economy benefit since Rouhani's election, but in the last number of months as well, and in mm-hmm. particular in the last month, we've seen some economic growth. We've seen a number of European companies meeting with officials from Iran. We've seen energy companies from Europe, I mean, major energy companies meeting to try and see if there's any opportunities. And so there's a very, very much a real worry that this process could not completely unravel, but could dent the current international sanctions regime. And so that's, I think, a real worry, and that's something that right now we're seeing. You know, I think it was the IMF that came out with some recent numbers. They expect Iran's economy to grow by 1% this coming year, and more mm-hmm. than that, slightly more than that, mm-hmm. 1.2, I think, the following year. And that's a big change. You know, last year, their economy retracted, and so there's very much a worry that this has kind of changed the game and changed the economic situation on the ground in Tehran and greater Iran.
Right. I mean, I think those are all good points. I think some things also to keep in mind. One, on in terms of, you know, the economic growth that's forecast for Iran, I think right now, I think it's an open question of how much of that is from factors unrelated to sanctions relief. How much of it is the fact that so much, you know, while the sanctions did certainly negatively impact Iran's economy, there was also a great deal of economic mismanagement by Ahmadinejad and his allies. Mm-hmm.
No, that's right. And there's, you know, the world economy is stronger than it was a couple of years mm-hmm. ago, and you're right. I mean, talk about there was mismanagement, corruption in contracts, so there's definitely some major issues, so it's unfair to say, and I'm not trying to say that mm-hmm. this is the only reason that the economy is starting to grow, but there's clearly been a turnaround that has started to occur. It may mm-hmm. not be a very large turnaround, but there's something on the ground that's changing, and so I think when we talk about the sanctions and the perception that sanctions could be eased, that does raise some concerns. I mean, there's a lot of sanctions is about perceptions. And if there's a perception right. that companies will be punished, they're less likely to do business and engage with the regime. And so that's something that is, I think, worrisome that we've seen.
Well, I think this is something that the administration has also been very, very conscious of and has made clear in a number of ways, you know, reminding people that the sanctions, you know, there are very specific elements of sanctions relief that Iran has been granted as a part of the JPA. But, you know, you can have meetings, but nobody should get the idea that this whole edifice is just going to come down or that the United States is going to stop enforcing these sanctions. So, I mean, I think you're right. You've seen a number of mainly European companies going to Tehran to have these meetings. There's kind of a sense of like, okay, we can see the end of this process. We can see, you know, an eventual reality where many of these sanctions are gone. And so there is a sense among these companies of, well, we want to be the first ones back into Iran. I mean, I recognize that, but I think there's, while I recognize the danger of, you know, creating this momentum that's hard to reverse, I would say, or I would ask, you know, to what extent does this actually act as another form of pressure on Iran? If you create this momentum and this sense within Iran, especially among Iran's business class, that, okay, this government is now preparing and slowly achieving an end to this massive pressure, this isolation, these severe economic constraints. It seems to me that you get the Rouhani administration invested in this kind of optimism, and that they understand that they could be severely punished if they fail to follow through. So it seems to me this also acts as a greater incentive for them to make a deal that results in real, you know, much broader sanctions relief instead of pushing a harder and harder line in negotiations. Does that make sense?
I see what you're saying, but I guess it goes back to a previous question and actually comments that you made about the hold on power in Iran. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing for the business community to benefit from this, but it's another question about the people making decisions on the ground and supreme leader at the end of the day who controls the portfolio of the nuclear program and his decision making. And so I think those things are not exactly connected. And there's one, to a certain extent, it is to maintain power and, you know, continue to have an economy that allows him to maintain power. It's a completely other thing to have the people of Iran benefit from sanctions relief, to benefit from an open and free economy, and to, you know, economically engage with the rest of the world. And that's not something that we've seen in a number of years. And it's kind of, I'd be very impressed. I'd be happy to find out that they were changing course based on the past history. Does it seem somewhat unlikely? But
yeah, no, I think that's a very fair point. But I think, I mean, just going back to one of the arguments that, you know, I think, and just to kind of restate it, I think, it is a very part of what I see Khamenei, the supreme leader, doing right now is that he's empowered and supported Rouhani and his administration to deal on the nuclear file, to engage in these negotiations, to make certain concessions while observing very strict red lines, particularly with regard to Iran's claimed right to enrich uranium on its own soil. But he's also created a situation where if the negotiations fail, then he's able to put it all on Rouhani and simply turn around and say, oh, well, my original suspicions about the United States and the, you know, the West and the great state and what have you were all correct. They were not willing to come to an agreement with us. And by the way, Rouhani screwed this all up. And I'm going to go back to supporting my, you know, my very conservative allies. But I think one of the things that, you know, does continue to strike me about Rouhani's argument during the campaign, one of the themes that he hit was a sort of recognition that Iran's posture, especially Ahmadinejad, specifically Ahmadinejad, that Ahmadinejad through his, you know, flamboyant craziness, you know, Holocaust denial, you know, et cetera, that his style and his approach to international relations had put Iran in a bad position. And I think this worked alongside, you know, one of the things that President Obama, you know, this was kind of a main tenet of President Obama's approach. And he made this point even when he was still running in the primary in 2007 and 2008, you know, was the United States needed to kind of go the extra mile to demonstrate both to the rest of the world and to Iranians that the United States was not the recalcitrant party in trying to address this problem, that the United States was ready to negotiate, was ready to come to some reasonable accommodation with Iran, but that it was Iran that was the real problem. Now, I think, you know, here in the United States, we might react to this, or some might react to this and say, well, okay, that's obvious. Iran is clearly the problem. But it wasn't so obvious to others. It's something that needed to be underlined, you know, very strongly with a big magic marker as much as possible. And I think by reaching out to Iran, by, you know, these various Nowruz greetings, by conciliatory statements. And I think there's criticism to be made in there. Did he do enough? Did he do too much? But I think when I look at the way Rouhani was, the things he was saying when he was running, I think there's evidence that made an impact on Iranians as well as you know, the global community, if I can call it that. That, you know, the global coalition to put pressure on Iran was strengthened significantly by the United States repeatedly demonstrating that it was willing to deal, it was willing to act in good faith, it was willing to negotiate, and that it would rather deal with this problem around a negotiating table than through other, perhaps, you know, measures that could lead to greater tensions. Do you agree?
Well, no, I guess I would say that, I think when Rouhani obviously knew what he was saying, and there was reasons that he said things, you know, we saw right after his election, basically what some people deemed a charm offensive, mm-hmm. you know, he was saying the right things in public. He was talking about the need to negotiate to reach an agreement on this nuclear pact. But we didn't see Iran's kind of strategic interests change at all. I mean, mm-hmm. we see this is a regime that continues to kind of repress its people, that continues to fund the Assad regime. I mean, the New York mm-hmm. Times reported last week that Tehran has sent, I think it was 330 truckloads of weapons, armed equipment to their, you know, mm-hmm. their allies in Syria. And so this is a regime that, well, may have been saying the right things, was still not acting in a way that a country in the world, in the international community that respects international norms and laws, that's not how they were abiding. And so that does continue to raise questions. And I guess, you know, we talk about the pressures and we talk about, you know, the administration here in the United States and Washington, the Obama administration coming in and talking about the need to negotiate in goodwill. I mean, you know, before the president entered office, or you know, the United States and its international partners worked at the United Nations to pass a number of Security Council resolutions, binding, in fact. And so there was kind of this view that Iran was a problem. And I think Rouhani clearly understood the rhetoric did make a difference. And that was part of the reason for that change. And on their part, it's a very clever idea. And it's worked well. I mean, he is much more respected. And I'm not trying to say that he's the same as the previous president of the country, but there's still issues and there's clearly still reasons to doubt the regime and their sincerity. Mm-hmm. And so they do have to make, you know, as I'm sure you'd agree, they have to prove that they are willing to reach an agreement. They're prove that they're willing to abide by their obligations. And until we see that, I think it's fair to assess that the regime should be doubted, and we should have to verify what they're doing mm-hmm. because they simply cannot be trusted on some accounts.
So let's turn quickly to the question of, you know, broadening the negotiations. Right now, they're narrowly focused on the nuclear question. There was a piece, I think it was in the Washington Post, by Ray Take, who is actually one of the signers of the FBI letter, calling on the United States, saying that, you know, we're in a position right now where we've got Iran under pressure. So now is an opportune time to include a human rights element in these negotiations. Now, I really have a hard time imagining how you get Russian and Chinese support for a plank like that. I mean, before we get into even any of the other debates, like what sort of human rights aspect do you think? I mean, assuming you agree with Take, and I'm sorry if that's a wrong assumption, but I just have a hard time imagining what kind of, if you could get anything meaningful on human rights included here that Russia and China would support.
It would be, I think you're right, it would be incredibly difficult. And in terms of, I have to read the article, I haven't read it yet today, but to look back at our human rights, and human rights should definitely be on the table when we talk about our relationship with Iran and the mm-hmm. regime. And the administration has done a very good job, I think, enforcing a lot of sanctions, economic sanctions, targeting human rights abusers in that country. And it's something that we should continue to do. I think it was in December, the administration, the Treasury Department named a number of individuals in Iran and cited them for human rights abuses, I believe it was, and put them on a sanctions list, and and Iran threatened to step away from negotiations and talks because of it. But I think the United States should stand firm and the international partners should stand firm because human rights should be a top priority.
Yeah.
And whether it's involved in negotiations or not, it should still be at the top of our list in terms of what we hold the regime accountable.
So yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I disagreed with Take's piece just, you know, for the reason I mentioned, but also, you know, we have, it seems like the argument that Take was making is like, well, we have this opportunity, let's ask for everything now. And I just don't think, I mean, I think it seems to me that's a very, very good way to completely scuttle the opportunity. I mean, Iran's nuclear program is an immediate problem. It needs to be addressed. It seems to be a much better idea to, you know, now that we have this international support, we've got the P5+1 united around dealing with this problem, you know, broadening the menu of things we're trying to get solved would be a bad decision.
Clearly, well, I would just, sorry, quickly, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I would say that the human rights situation is an immediate problem as well. And so it would be, I think, unfair to say that it is just the nuclear issue that we should be worried about at this current time, because there continue to be abuses and targeted abuses in Iran that we should be very worried about. And we have been, but it should be maybe higher on the list. And so
I agree. Okay. Yeah. I agree with that. It was probably a wrong phrasing by me, but my point is, you know, we've got unity around this nuclear question. So it seems wise to me to keep that file separate and focus. Yes. If and when we get the nuclear issue dealt with, the United States will still have a whole range of issues that it has problems with with Iran. Human rights is and should be a priority among them. Its support for terrorist groups, its support for the Assad regime. You know, and it's not like once we sign a nuclear agreement, those problems go away. I think the United States has made clear correctly that, you know, this term rapprochement gets thrown around much too carelessly, in my view. We still have a whole range of issues that we'll have to work through with Iran. But I just wanted to bring up this piece in the Huffington Post today by the Iranian dissident Akbar Ganji, who I think made a similar point. He was like, listen, I have a very, he's a supporter of human rights. He spent, he's done serious time in Evin prison for his activism. But he was saying, let's keep these talks focused on the nuclear issue. You know, for the Rouhani to be able to show for the Rouhani administration to be able to show progress on the nuclear file is the best way for them to then have the opportunity to make reforms on some of these other issues, and human rights being one of the most important. And granted, it's a chance. It's not to say that that's going to happen. It's just, I think he made a fairly strong case that this is kind of the most realistic path that we can see toward an improvement on the human rights front in Iran. Were Rouhani to fail, and if Iran withdraws from the negotiating table, and the hardliners were once again empowered, it's very difficult to see how the human rights situation in Iran improves, certainly in the short or medium term.
You know, I think there's some truth to that. I guess that at the end of the day, it's first of all, I would say it's not just a United States concern, and it's an international concern. And while China and Russia obviously probably do not agree, I think there is kind of unanimity when we talk about other partners in Asia and in Europe. And so it's more than just kind of a United States concern, and it should be. And I think you would agree on that as well. It's hard to separate the issues, because when we look at the nuclear issue and the nuclear portfolio, and we look at international financial sanctions to date, if sanctions are relieved in any way, if the Iranian economy does, you know, continue to grow and the regime continues to stay in power, you know, there's nothing to say that they will kind of go down this path towards reforms and human rights reforms. And so, you know, it could continue the staying power of the regime. And so there, I think there's continued worries, and there's no guarantee to say what they do or what they don't do, or, you know, are the leaders in Iran kind of united on this issue? It doesn't seem like it. And is the international community? No, but I don't know. I guess at the end of the day, it should be an issue that should be of top concern, and we should bring it about. Maybe if it doesn't happen in the nuclear negotiations, there's side negotiations. You know, there's rumors that Secretary of State Kerry could meet the Iranian officials on the site of Davos this weekend or this week. And so that would be a time for that to be brought up. And, you know, at the same time, it should be a time for the United States to look into these abuses and continue to pressure and exert pressure with international financial sanctions targeting these human rights abusers. And that's one way to really leverage this opportunity and show the regime that the nuclear program and human rights are connected. And hopefully that can bring about some change on the situation on the ground.
Right. I mean, while I agree that we should continue to make this an issue, I think there is one of the things that Ganji brought up is that the danger here, if we link these issues, that it would affirm some of the more paranoid beliefs of hardliners in the Iranian system, including Khamenei, where he says that, you know, their suspicion is that, you know, the nuclear issue is just kind of a fig leaf for this broader effort at regime change. So, you know, I'm not saying that we should take these beliefs as and let them dictate what our policy should or shouldn't be. But I think it is, you know, it's important that he brings it up and helps us understand why it's probably wiser to sort of cordon off the nuclear issue and try to get that dealt with, while at the same time still, you know, making clear that we have serious problems with Iran on human rights. I would also make a note here about the Obama administration's support for the creation of a UN special rapporteur for human rights in Iran back in 2010. I think this was it 2010 or 2011? I guess it was 2011. You know, the U.S. pushed hard for this, and Iran lobbied very, very hard against the creation of a UN special rapporteur because they understood that this was not just the United States making a case against Iran's human rights. This was the United Nations now. This was the international community speaking against Iran's human rights abuses. So I think here this is, and it's kind of consistent with what I see as the Obama administration's approaches here to kind of competently internationalize the approach and internationalize the pressure to a much, much greater extent and get the U.S. and its international partners speaking with one voice on the issue. Excuse me. So rather than just the United States making these condemnations, which I think it's fairly easy for Iranian politicians and leaders to dismiss, given that the United States is, of course, the great Satan. When you have the United Nations making these kinds of criticisms, it's much, much harder for them to dismiss.
I think there's some truth to that, but I think I don't want to undermine. I think there is, the United States does still carry a very important voice in the world. And it's very difficult to get, the United Nations to agree on some of these issues. And so the United States does have very important power and an ability to enforce kind of and to back up what we're talking about here. And, to internationalize these issues is very important. It doesn't have to be at the United Nations level, though. And it shouldn't stop the United States and our partners from moving forward on some of these issues as we've done in the past. And so I would just say that, there's more than just condemnation. It is actually taking those actions to hold up these standards that we believe the Iranians and other countries in the world should respect. And so the United States does play a key role. And while the United Nations may not agree on issues or might condemn certain atrocities, it's actually the bite of financial pressures, hopefully, that can bring about some change in behavior. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I think that brings us to the end. Patrick, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and have a safe commute home in the
Thank you. In the Good winter luck in wonderland. The snow.
All right. Talk to you later.